content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Today's first article is entitled, A Way to Predict Coastal Flooding Was Hiding in Plain Sight, by Ian Rose. The clock is ticking for many low-lying coastal areas. Sea level is rising at historic rates, promising to radically redraw the map. But locating precisely which plots will be inundated and which will remain dry land is a much more daunting task. That effort may have an ally almost no one would have guessed, one of the smallest and least conspicuous forms of life, lichens. More than 3,600 species of lichens have been identified in North America alone. Each is a community made up of one or more species of fungus and an alga or cyanobacteria. This combination has enabled lichens to survive in diverse and often hostile conditions, as varied as tropical heat and bitter Antarctic cold. To scratch out their niche, various lichens have developed tolerance to different levels of temperature, light, air quality, and other factors. Because of this sensitivity, lichens are already used by scientists to gauge environmental disturbances, such as atmospheric pollution. Lichens also vary in their salt tolerance. It's this property, says Roger Rosentreter, a botanist at Idaho's Boise State University, that makes them so useful in understanding sea level rise. Lichens are a good indicator of site history, says Rosentreter, who has studied lichens and related species for more than 40 years. Specifically, the species of lichens that grow on a coastal site may be an effective indicator of low levels of saltwater intrusion and spray, which can be caused by infrequent flooding or storm events. Because sea levels are continuing to rise, any site that has experienced occasional saltwater intrusion in the past is likely to see more frequent flooding and storm effects in the future. Recently, Rosentreter and his wife, fellow Boise State botanist Anne DeBolt, studied the lichen communities of two state parks near West Palm Beach, Florida. One park on a barrier island is subject to frequent salt spray and storm flooding, and the other is inland just 500 meters away. The scientists found two surprisingly different lichen communities at each site. By comparing the two, they started building a list of lichen species that can be useful indicators of the long-term and historical presence of saltwater. It takes more than just salt sensitivity to make a lichen a good indicator of whether a site has experienced the first effects of sea level rise. The lichen's own life history also comes into play. Species such as the powdery medallion lichen can be killed if subjected to too much salt water by a storm or flood, but this lichen's quick reproduction lets it swiftly recolonize after the sea recedes. Larger species with slower growth and reproduction, and with also low salt tolerance, such as the ruffled blue jellyskin, can better tell the saltwater history of a site. These salt-intolerant lichens likely could not have survived and grown if a saltwater event, such as a storm spray or flooding, had occurred. Because some lichen species can live for decades or longer, the record they provide can be both hyperlocal in space and extensive in time. Of the 48 different lichen species Rosentreter and DeBolt found at their two Florida survey sites, 11 are potential indicators of saltwater's presence. 7 of the species like to grow only in places with very low saltwater impact, while 4 are salt tolerant. So finding them growing at a site suggests that it has a moderate history of salt and a higher risk of being affected by rising seas. In general, Rosentreter and DeBolt found that the species that best indicate if a site will be relatively safe from sea level rise and saltwater inundation are larger and leafier lichens, many of them light green or bluish in color. But lichens can be tricky to identify, and some promising indicator species look quite similar to less useful ones. You've got to be at least an intermediate plant person to figure it out, says Rosentreter. The good thing is these aren't just in Florida. They're in the whole southeast coastal plain, he says. For example, reports on iNaturalist, the California Advisory Academy of Sciences and National Geographic Nature app, put the ruffled blue jellyskin all along the U.S. East Coast and beyond. Borga G. Ruggiero, a UC Santa Cruz expert in conserving natural defenses against sea level rise, who was not involved in the research, sees parallels between how coastal communities and lichens handle environmental change. It makes a lot of sense to find those indicator species where the frequency of spray or flood events are over a threshold, where some species are not able to live anymore, he says. You could say the same thing about humans and coastal infrastructure. You get to a tipping point where specific neighborhoods get flooded so regularly that they don't get insurance. Modern science offers an array of tools to study sea level rise, including satellite data and groundwater and soil sampling. Lichens could be another way to see, at smaller site-specific scales, where the sea is coming next and, just as important, where it is not. Today's second article is entitled Prepare for the Text Apocalypse by Matthew Kirschenbaum. This is from Technology Section. What if in the end we are not done in by intercontinental ballistic missiles or climate change, not by microscopic pathogens or a mountain-sized meteor, but by text? Simple, plain, unadorned text, but in quantities so immense as to be all but unimaginable. A tsunami of text wept into self-perpetuating cataract of content that makes it functionally impossible to reliably communicate in any digital setting. Our relationship to the written word is fundamentally changing. So-called generative artificial intelligence, or AI, has gone mainstream through programs like ChatGPT, which uses large language models, or LLMs, to statistically predict the next letter or word in a sequence, yielding sentences and paragraphs that mimic the content of whatever documents they are trained on. They have brought something like autocomplete to the entirety of the internet. For now, people are still typing the actual prompts for these programs and likewise, but the models are still trained on human prose instead of their own machine-made opuses. But circumstances could change, as evidenced by the release last week of an application programming interface for ChatGPT, which will allow the technology to be integrated directly into web applications such as social media and online shopping. It is easy now to imagine a setup wherein machines could prompt other machines to put out text ad infinitum, flooding the internet with synthetic text devoid of human agency or intent. Exactly that scenario played out recently on a small scale when last June a tweaked version of JPTJ, an open source model, was patched into the anonymous message board and posted 15,000 largely toxic messages in 24 hours. Say someone sets up a system for a program like ChatGPT to query itself repeatedly and automatically publish the output on websites and social media, an endlessly iterating stream of content that does little more than get in everyone's way, but that also gets absorbed back into the training sets for models publishing their own new content on the internet. What if lots of people, whether motivated by advertising money or political or ideological agendas or just mischief-making, were to start doing that, with hundreds and then thousands and perhaps millions or billions of such posts every single day flooding the open internet, commingling with search results, spreading across social media platforms, infiltrating Wikipedia entries, and above all, providing fodder to be mined for future generations of machine learning systems. Like the prized pen strokes of a calligrapher, a human document online could become a rarity to be curated, protected, and preserved. Meanwhile, the algorithmic underpinnings of society will operate on a textual knowledge base that is more and more artificial, its origins in the ceaseless churn of the language models. Think of it as an ongoing planetary spam event, but unlike spam, for which we have more or less effective safeguards, there may prove to be no reliable way of flagging and filtering the next generation of machine-made text. Don't believe everything you read may become, don't believe anything you read when it's online. This is an ironic outcome for digital text, which has long been seen as an empowering format. More recently, advocates of so-called minimal computing have endorsed plain text as a format with a low carbon footprint that is easily shareable regardless of platform constraints. But plain text is also the easiest digital format to automate. People have been doing it in one form or another since the 1950s. Content farms that churn out low-quality prose to attract adware employ these tools, but they still depend on legions of under- or unemployed creatives to string characters into proper words, words into legible sentences, sentences into coherent paragraphs. Once automating and scaling up that labor is possible, what incentive will there be to rein it in? William Safire, who was among the first to diagnose the rise of content as a unique internet category in the late 1990s, was also perhaps the first to point out that content need bear no relation to truth or accuracy in order to fulfill its basic function, which is simply to exist, or as Kate Eichhorn has argued in her recent book about content, to circulate. That's because the appetite for content is at least as much about creating new targets for advertising revenue as it is the actual sustenance for human audiences. This is to say nothing of the even darker agendas, such as the kind of information warfare we now see across the global geopolitical sphere. There's still another dimension here. Text is content, but it's a special kind of content, meta-content, if you will. Beneath the surface of every web page, you will find text, angle-bracketed instructions, or code, for how it should look and behave. Browsers and servers connect by exchanging text. Programming is done in plain text. Images and video and audio are all described, tagged, if you will, with text called metadata. The web is much more than text, but everything on the web is text at some fundamental level. For a long time, the basic paradigm has been what we have termed the read-write web. We not only consume content, but we could also produce it, participating in creation of web thought edits, comments, and uploads. We are now on the verge of something more like a write-write web, the web writing and rewriting itself, maybe even rewiring itself in the process. We face, in essence, a crisis of never-ending spam, a debilitating amalgamation of human and machine authorship. From Finn Bruton's 2013 book, Spam, A Shadow History of the Internet, we learn about existing methods for spreading spurious content on the Internet, such as bifacing websites which feature pages that are designed for human readers and others that are optimized for the bot crawlers that populate search engines. Email messages composed as a pastiche of famous literary works harvested from online corpora, such as Product Gutenberg, the better to sneak past filters, whole networks of blogs populated by autonomous content to drive links and traffic, and algorithmic journalism, where automated reporting on such topics as sports scores, the stock market ticker, and seismic tremors is put out over the wires. All of these phenomena, to say nothing of the garden variety Viagra spam that used to be such a nuisance, are functions of text, more text than we can imagine or contemplate, only the merest slivers of it ever glimpsed by human eyeballs, but that clog up servers, telecom cables, and data centers nonetheless. 120 billion messages a day, surging in a gray tide of text around the world, trickling through the filters, as dull as smog, as Burton puts it. We have often talked about the Internet as a great flowering of human expression and creativity, nothing less than a worldwide web of buzzing connectivity. But there is a very strong argument that probably as early as the mid-1990s, when corporate interests began establishing footholds, it was already on its way to becoming something very different. Not just commercialized in the usual sense, the very fabric of the network was transformed into an engine for minting capital. The enormous mid-range of workaday writing content is where generative artificial intelligence is already starting to take hold. The first indicator of the integration into word processing software, ChatGPT will be tested in office. It may also soon be in your doctor's notes or your lawyer's brief. It is also possibly a silent partner in something you've already read online today. Unbelievably, a major research university has acknowledged using ChatGPT to script a campus-wide email message in response to the mass shooting at Michigan State. Meanwhile, the editor of a long-running science fiction journal released data that show a dramatic uptick in spammed submissions beginning late last year, coinciding with ChatGPT's rollout. Days later, he was forced to close submissions altogether because of the deluge of automated content. And Amazon has seen an influx of titles that claimed ChatGPT co-authorship on its Kindle Direct platform, where the economies of scale mean even a handful of sales will make money. Whether or not a fully automated Texopolis comes to pass, the trends are only accelerating. From a piece of genre fiction to your doctor's report, you may not always be able to presume human authorship behind whatever it is you are reading. Writing, but more specifically digital text, as a category of human expression, will become estranged from us. The properties window for the document in which I am working lists a total of 941 minutes of editing and some 60 revisions. That's more than 15 hours. Whole paragraphs have been deleted, inserted, and deleted again. All of that before it even gets to a copy editor or a fact checker. Am I worried that ChatGPT could have done that work better? No. But I am worried that it may not matter. Swept up as training data for the next generation of generative artificial intelligence, my words here won't be able to help themselves. They too will be fossil fuel for the coming text-pocalypse. Our third article today is entitled "Nostalgia is a Shield Against Unhappiness" by Arthur C. Brooks. Ever since our earliest days together in our mid-20s, my wife has known about a mystical place called Lincoln City. It's a modest beach town on the central Oregon coast, but for me, it holds a Shangri-La-like mythos. Lincoln City is where I spent one blissful week each year as a boy, combing the rough beaches for agates, fishing off the local pier, and playing with matches in the fire pit outside my aunt's trailer home. These are the very happiest of my childhood memories. So it was with great anticipation that, not long after marrying, I took my wife to visit the best place in the world. For me, it was every bit as glorious as I remembered. For her, not so much. She was very pregnant at the time and couldn't stand the overpowering stench of dead fish. Given that she's a native of warm Mediterranean shores, I shouldn't have been surprised that she spent the weekend huddled in our motel room to avoid the howling wind. Ever since, she has considered Lincoln City to be a glitch in my psychological matrix, an unexplainable, almost pathological affection with no basis in reality. Normally, my assessments of a place or experience differ little, if at all, from my wife's. If she hates a dinner party, I probably do so too. In this case, our wildly different perceptions of Lincoln City can be explained by one of the strangest and most overpowering feelings that humans possess, nostalgia. This brew of memory, emotion, and desire can twist our perceptions and judgments, turning even pain into pleasure, or dead fish into the sweetest French perfume. That gives it a unique power to combat unhappiness. Psychologists have defined nostalgia as a self-conscious social emotion, bittersweet but predominantly positive. It develops out of happy memories mixed with a yearning for the past and the close relationships we had back then. Often, nostalgia involves sensory stimuli. For example, the smell of autumn leaves might provoke an intense longing for your childhood home. Neuroscientists have found that it is a complex cognitive phenomenon involving many parts of the brain, including some that are implicated in self-reflection, autobiographical memory, emotional regulation, and reward processing. Almost everyone experiences nostalgia, although its object tends to vary throughout life. One survey conducted by the psychologist Christine Irene Batchko found that younger people felt more nostalgia for pets, toys, and holidays than did older people, who felt it more strongly for music. I came of age in the 1980s, and even songs I found hopelessly annoying back then, say the torturous 1982 hit Man Eater by Hall & Oates, can fill me with nostalgic sentiment. As my colleague Julie Beck has written, nostalgia was originally viewed as an emotional malady when it was first defined in the late 17th century. And crucially, it often occurs when people are experiencing negative moods or having bad experiences. Loneliness can be a trigger, as researchers found in 2008. Another is bad weather, or Hall & Oates. Despite its association with negative emotions, nostalgia does not cause or exacerbate unhappiness. Rather, nostalgia is a defense response to unhappiness, one that brings relief from a negative mood. Psychologists writing in the Journal of Personality and Sociology in 2006 found that provoking nostalgia in experiments strengthened people's social bonds, boosted their positive feelings about themselves, and improved their mood. Similar research has shown that when people feel nostalgia, it can bolster their sense of life's meaning, lower an existential reaction to the idea of death, increase spirituality, and raise optimism. Scholars aren't exactly sure why nostalgia works. Some have speculated that reminiscing about happy memories affirms valued aspects of the self in situations when we might otherwise feel lonely or unworthy. Either way, its emotional intensity allows the joy of the past to overpower the unpleasantness of the present, a little nugget of escapism that helps us get through the bad times. No matter how nostalgia works, the science to date finds more than enough evidence to conclude that it is good for us. Given its benefits, we could all gain from nurturing it consciously, so we're better prepared to counteract bad moods when they arise. Here are some ways to do so. 1. Find a shortcut to your happy place. Think of a memory of a specific place and time that gives you a feeling of warmth, the kind you reflexively turn to in moments of distress. Now find a picture or object that reminds you of that place and keep it in hand. Maybe it's a song stored on your phone or a picture of yourself as a child sitting in your grandmother's lap. Better yet, if possible, find something that holds a smell that stimulates the nostalgic glow. Researchers have found that scent-induced nostalgia can be especially effective at raising happiness, self-esteem, optimism, and social connectedness. You could find a candle that smells like a sprig of pine to remind you of your childhood Christmases, or air freshener that evokes cut grass from summer days gone by. I thought of keeping a dead fish in my desk at work to remind me of Lincoln City, but feared my colleagues might not see the charm in that. 2. Anticipate your memories. When you think back on the memories that give you nostalgia, they probably feel like kismet, which is part of why they're so appealing. But your nostalgic memories can have the same effect even if they're deliberately manufactured. Writing in the journal Cognition and Emotion in 2019, researchers reported that when people anticipated feeling nostalgic about a current experience, they were more likely to experience that nostalgia later and get a corresponding boost in their social feelings of social connection and sense of meaning. You can run such an experiment in your own life. The next time you are having a good time with family and friends, take a mental snapshot, consciously committing the details to memory. You might even write them down. Note that these are the days that will someday make you say, those were the days. Later, when you are in a negative mood, you are much more likely to pull off this reminiscence. 3. Build traditions. A researcher writing in the Harvard Business Review in 2021 made the case that nostalgia can help build strong bonds in groups. I've seen this happen myself. At Harvard, I regularly speak to alumni gatherings, including to retirees who graduated from business school 60 or even 70 years ago. The participants get intense joy from seeing their classmates and reminiscing about their old times together. They laugh at memories that are objectively mundane and tear up at simple stories of ordinary things they saw and did together. We can forge more of these strong bonds in our families, friend groups, and workplaces by creating traditions and rituals and recalling them as the years go by. Create holidays around events you experienced with others in the past, such as sports you played as kids or the formation of a friend group in a big city after college. Mark the occasion regularly so people have something to look forward to. The occasion you're celebrating doesn't even have to be purely wonderful. For what it's worth, alumni seem to be just as nostalgic about terrible classes as they are about the good ones. Perhaps because it is so powerful and complex, nostalgia has received magical treatment from poets and writers. The past is hidden somewhere outside the realm, beyond the reach of the intellect, Marcel Proust wrote. On a 4th century BC Greek tablet, we find the anonymous inscription, "I am parched with thirst and I perish. Give me quickly the cool water flowing from the lake of memory, and of their own accord they will give you a drink from the holy spring." I have never read a poem about Lincoln City, but on a windy, chilly day, the sort that would normally make me grumpy, the waft of fish will bring me as much magic as any verse. That was from the March 2023 issue of The Atlantic. Arthur Brooks is a contributing writer at The Atlantic and the host of How to Build a Happy Life podcast. Okay, we are about out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and have a positive day.